I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, this is the 7th episode of the DesignFootball.com podcast. My name is Jay. I am the resident blogger on designfootball.com, as always. Today I'm joined by Dennis Hurley. We said on the last podcast that it would be someone new on this podcast, but it's not. It's Dennis Hurley who's been on before, but that's great also. Hello, Dennis.
Good morning, Jay. I'm sorry that I'm not someone new, but I'll try my best to be fresh and inventive.
Yeah. It was disappointing, but we'll have to make do. Don't go, please don't go.
Are you talking to me or the listeners?
How are you, Dennis?
I'm well. I'm happy with life. Arsenal having beaten Leicester 5-0 last week was a big contributing factor to that.
We're doing that again. That's great. I might actually work very, very hard to release this podcast before that game happens.
Okay.
Just to spite you.
I'll just look like a seer or so, won't I?
Yeah. That's. I don't know. You did beat them. We're not going to talk about that. Yeah. We'll talk about Arsenal another day.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. So something we said we would do on this podcast was talk about rugby and rugby's influence on football. And Dennis runs the website internationalrugbyshirts.com, which is the closest thing to a full gallery of rugby kits, illustrated rugby kits, that there is on the internet, or certainly that I've found so far. Dennis, the evolution of rugby kits, rugby shirts and so on, how has that happened? Because it turned professional when? In the mid-90s?
It was just after the 1995 World Cup in South Africa. Professionalism had been rumoured for years and years, and there was talk of a Kerry Packer-style breakaway of these super teams. But eventually, all of the national federations were kind of, they got on board. Well, they were given no other option other than to get on board. So yeah, I suppose it's just gone. It's 20-year anniversary.
Okay. So it's fitting that we're talking about it right now because the Six Nations is on. I don't know how popular that is in places that don't have a team competing in the Six Nations, but
it doesn't register at all.
Okay, so this, yeah, all right. Well, just to let people know, then the Six Nations is a rugby tournament between the best Northern Hemisphere rugby teams, international rugby teams. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I just made a joke there. The best rugby teams and Scotland.
And Scotland.
Shouldn't laugh. Scotland came closer to the World Cup semi-finals than Ireland did. So, sorry to all the Scots out there.
Okay. I think that joke seems to transcend sports.
it's just the way it's gone, really, isn't it? Like, it's the home of golf, and there's no real great Scottish golfers anymore. And, well, I suppose in fairness, Andy Murray is at the top of his sport, but it seems like a small payback. Like, they should have really beaten Ireland in the qualifying for Euro 2016, and they really just kind of blew their chance. And the rugby hasn't been good for a while. But then they nearly beat Australia. So maybe there is hope. Like, I suppose they needed to beat England last week, but it didn't really happen for them.
Okay, I mean, I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. I know nothing about rugby. But you should also be aware that Andy Murray is British rather than Scottish ever since he's started winning.
I think that joke is so hackneyed, really, isn't it? And I don't think there's any real basis.
What, for him being British?
I don't think there's any truth in the fact that he's Scottish when he loses and British when he wins. He like when he loses, he's still Britain's Andy Murray. Like, it's not like they don't still support him.
Yeah, but he loses in the final now.
So that makes him more British.
Yeah.
If you can find examples, I think there was a study done on it last year, and it basically concluded that it was a lot of hogwash.
Okay. I think he became British when he did actually bow to the royal box, despite saying he wasn't going to. So maybe that's the line in the sand, I suppose.
Okay, I'll take your word for that.
Okay, so we should maybe talk about rugby a little bit. So the 20th anniversary of rugby becoming professional, also the Six Nations. Six Nations, Google it if you don't know what the Six Nations is, but it's a big rugby tournament in the Northern Hemisphere, but all the Northern Hemisphere teams are rubbish anyway, so you're probably better watching the Tri Nations or something. What's it called in the Southern Hemisphere?
It's rather haughtily called the Rugby Championship ever since they let Argentina into it.
Oh, of course, there is now, and they're not bad either. They used to be rubbish, but now they're quite good.
But the Rugby Championship is, with golf it's okay because the Open Championship was the first, the original and best. But this is just a real kind of up yours to the Six Nations, I think.
The Rugby Championship. Yeah, but they are better, so you. There is some basis for saying that they are all better. Didn't Argentina knock Ireland out of the Rugby World Cup?
They did, yeah. All the four
Okay.
semi-finalists were the four teams in the Rugby Championship.
Okay. Well, there you go. There's the argument for. And also, just a point you made there, Scotland did beat Ireland in the run up to
Euro
Euro
2016.
2016,
I
May.
meant finish ahead of them in the group.
Ah, yeah, but we shouldn't forget the actual in on in a match and on aggregate also, I believe.
Yeah, that's correct, but are we saying that Chelsea were a better team than Manchester United in 93-94 because they beat them 1-0 twice?
Okay.
Leaving aside the FA Cup final, of course, which Man United won 4-0.
Okay. The rugby then. So 20 years since it went professional. Now, when it went professional in 1995, there was a big difference between what a football kit looked like at that time and a rugby kit. What sort of, in terms of years, how far behind would you say rugby kits were at that point, behind football kits? I assume they were behind.
Yeah, I suppose you'd say maybe about 40 years, so if you're putting years on it, because they were wearing what are known universally as rugby shirts, with the kind of shirt-like collar and the cottony kind of material, which football teams were wearing in the 50s before evolving to the round neck and further on then to polyester and various other changes like that. So yeah, it probably was about 40 years of a difference, which seems incredible when you think of it.
Okay, so we're saying 40 years behind in 1995 when the transition happened from the amateur game into the professional game.
Yeah.
That seems a huge amount to be able to catch up, but since then they do seem to have caught up. Would that be right?
Yeah, well, I suppose I don't know, would you be comparing the two of them really, because they are very different types of games, so they need different performance equipment. But certainly the rugby kit has evolved hugely from the mid 90s. If you compared two pictures, they're worlds apart really. Like the jerseys used to be very baggy, with floppy collars, and now they're skin tight, practically sprayed on. And the main reason, I presume, is to prevent opposition players grabbing any part of the kit to try and stop a player carrying the ball. Which is why they got rid of the collars first of all, and then just kind of limited any area on the shirt that could be grabbed hold of.
Now, I did read somewhere that when they started playing in like the 1870s, they used to wear a shirt with a bow tie and walking boots. Now, obviously, it's evolved, even in the amateur game, it evolved on somewhat from that. And in football, it's only really that Spanish team that still wears bow ties. So I think since they've gone professional, the I think they're maybe even ahead of football, because you say about skin tight kits. The first skin tight kit I remember being commented on for its functionality was, I think it might be a rugby league team, Bradford Bulls or something. And I'm not sure which year it was, but the way I remember it, it was certainly something that had happened before football, say the Kappa Combat range and so on. Certainly before that was held up to be an innovation in football. It was rugby had led the way.
I'm not sure of that now because I wouldn't have a huge interest in rugby league, but rugby league was of course professional all along, so maybe that might indicate why that was a bit further ahead than rugby union.
Yeah, I suppose that would be the case. But even then, it seems like there's a level of intelligence in both games that either football doesn't have that intelligence, or for some reason football is holding on to some traditionalism. Because if you go back to rugby union, it's virtually all tradition has been dispensed with if you look at the kits now. So they're all right, they might be in similar colours, but so many sponsors and everything is very much geared towards performance on the pitch and advertising 15 different companies. So that takes the game forward a lot quicker than, say, football does, with its limitations.
I don't know what you say, it's more intelligence. Like with the money in football, you'd have to think that the manufacturers would have made whatever advances they could. I don't think the manufacturers kind of have this big list of stuff in a cartel somewhere, and that they're saying, okay, we'll launch this in 5 years' time and that'll improve things, and then the next thing in another 5 years. I just don't. I think with the large levels of physical contact in rugby, they need a different kind of kit. Whereas in football, the requirement isn't as pressing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, are you saying you don't think that there's a deliberate drip feeding or staggering of these releases, or
You just think it.
I don't think there is. Like, if you were the team who lost the Champions League final because of something like that, and you found out, oh, the manufacturers aren't going to introduce that until 2 years' time, would you take a court case against that?
I don't know.
Given
I would
the
like,
levels of
but
money involved
you wouldn't find out about it though, would you? I don't think.
you wouldn't.
I wouldn't have thought you'd find out, would you?
What, don't they work very closely with their technical suppliers?
Yeah, but the technical supplier will tell them exactly what they want to tell them. So, I mean, it's these meetings mean nothing. If you've got whoever the president is at the minute of Real Madrid, and he's talking to like someone from Adidas, they could tell him anything. He's not going to understand anything, is he? I don't think... Well, the managers, for the biggest clubs, the managers change so often, they probably don't sit in on those meetings. They're probably just given the kit at the beginning of the season and they have to work with it. Yeah. So anyone higher than that, a technical director, are they even going to care?
Yeah, but where would the motivation be to hold stuff back? Could they not just have the kit at the state-of-the-art level now and then just improve on that in a few years?
All right, well, as an example then, how long have rugby been using the technology of whatever they are, the heart sensors and all that kind of stuff? So England in the World Cup had stuff like that, didn't they?
How did they get on with the aid of all that stuff?
Well, that's well, it might be relevant, but they've still... I don't think that's the reason why they did poorly. Unless there is an argument in football, isn't there, that now the Opta statistics are so... they're being used to such an extent that players will prefer to play a short pass to make sure their pass completion rate goes up than they will play a long pass, which will affect their stats but could lead to a goal. So there is an argument that it's counterproductive there.
Yeah, but that's because some players are idiots. I think the bigger clubs use better metrics, don't they? I think I remember reading that in, was it the numbers game? Or else was it living on the volcano? That, you know, you can't just look at passes completed. Like, the top clubs definitely don't have such a narrow view of it.
All right, to use the technology element again then, in the 2003 World Cup, Clive Woodward and what he did with England then, if we're going to beat England with that stick, what they did with technology and the analyse and the sports science and all this kind of stuff seemed ahead of football at the time.
Yeah, and it was also ahead of every other rugby team at the time, yeah. Except France, I suppose, because they had the same kind of kit at that World Cup. But... at the same time, but England probably wouldn't have won that World Cup without Johnny Wilkinson. And, you know, that's outside of technology.
Well, I'm not... I don't know if that is outside of technology, because another thing they do in rugby is that the backs wear different boots to the forwards, don't they? Or I think they wear different boots and the stud lengths are different is probably the main difference, isn't it?
I'm not sure if the different boots thing happens as much as it used to. Just give me 1 second.
But what did Wilkinson wear in that World Cup? Did he wear Predators?
Predators, I'd imagine, yeah.
But so I said the football ones.
Yeah,
they weren't specially for rugby.
No, in the old days, a lot of players would wear very kind of high top boots with ankle supports. But I reckon a lot of that was kind of placebo stuff, because I'm just looking at a picture here now of Keane Healy, an Ireland prop, and he is wearing fairly normal football boots. So what they wore in the old days, you know, clearly they didn't develop that technology further, because it didn't give the performance increases they were looking for.
But that's, I suppose that's, an argument against what I'm saying about rugby being ahead, that because I've heard of Keane Healy, so for him not to have like a specific boot contract and be provided with the top of the range rugby specific boot, if not his own signature boot, that seems a little bit surprising.
No, but my point is that he probably does have a boot contract, but he's wearing football boots rather than special rugby boots.
But even then, why is there not a specific... Because surely what he does has got to be different to what a professional footballer does. So what his needs are have got to be different to that. So why is the best boot for him a football boot and not a specifically designed rugby boot?
Probably because the boot manufacturers wouldn't get enough out of it. Out of developing a special boot, and in terms of sales. Which is what it comes down to, really.
Yeah, it's something we mentioned before, that it's market driven before it is actually catering for the needs of the sports person, I suppose.
Yeah.
I wrote a piece on this about, it was 8 years ago now, about comparisons between rugby and football and the shirt styles. And I said the basic and unchanging principles of the design are still the priority. And I think I was referring to the New Zealand All Blacks shirt. Is that still the case, would you say, in 2016? Are they instantly recognisable, or are they poles apart from even the 87 team that won the World Cup?
Are the players instantly recognisable?
No, the shirts.
Instantly recognisable as an All Black shirt?
Yeah.
Well, the fact that it's black and it has a silver fern would mark it out as instantly recognisable, yeah. Have I misunderstood the question?
No, I understand the point you're making, but what I mean is, we've seen a gradual evolution from, say, 1987. So the World Cup is bookended by New Zealand teams winning
it. Yeah.
So we've seen an evolution, and which incorporates professionalism coming into it.
Yeah.
Between 87 and now 2015, when the last World Cup was.
Yeah.
Obviously the shirt has gradually changed, but if you were presented in 1987 with the current All Black shirt, would you be appalled by it, or would it be acceptable even then? It would look futuristic, but would you say, okay, well, this is okay as an All Black shirt?
It's a tough one to answer. But I don't think they'd be appalled by it, because it is still, you know, there's no doubting what it is on first glance. It's like saying, go back to 1987 and show Brazilian people the current Brazil shirt. It is what it is. Like, there's no confusing it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, but Brazil were rubbish. That 87 Brazil shirt was made by Topper.
Yeah, but so Brazil are rubbish now too.
Well, nothing changes. That's not something we can. That's not our conclusion today. That everything stays the same. Okay. So something that they do in rugby is, I think they have like textured shirts for the players. Is that right?
They have thing that's called grip tape, which helps them hold the ball better, carry the ball, hold on to it.
Okay, and so what is that? That's in the middle of the shirt, is it?
Yeah, it's this kind of rubbery material, which kind of helps the ball stick better. So you'd wonder really about the legality of it, but everyone has it, so it seems to be okay.
Okay, and so all teams basically have a version of this on the front of their shirt.
Yeah, they do, yeah. And the manufacturers have started to play with it a little bit by, you know, putting in little details on it, you know, historical stuff, or just a team's insignia repeated over and over again. But you'll like this one now. Wasps, their grip tape is just double check to make sure I'm right. Their grip tape is a load of little Land Rover logos. Because they're sponsored by Land Rover.
Really? Thanks. What colour is that? Is that like a watermark, does it look like? Or
yeah, kind of. Yeah. Like it's the same colour as the shirt itself.
Right, so
from a distance, when you're watching on television, it's hard to notice it. You'd only see it really close up.
Okay, so let's say, and I don't know if they do have any sort of regulations regarding sponsorship at all, because they literally, I'm not sure whether literally is the right word, but they plaster the shirts with sponsors. So let's say there is a regulation, a limitation to how many sponsors you have on, that would bypass it, do you think? And it's not something we see in football, which we suggested on another podcast, that we could have sponsors as a watermark to bypass regulations, but it's not something we have, is it?
I don't know. It's a good question, really. Nobody would notice it, I suppose, enough for it to be viable, because you'd only see it very close up, and it's the same colour as the shirt, so I'm not sure there's any point in it.
I suppose, well, that's something we'll come on to in a second, because in rugby, just something I wanted to check. We talked about different boots maybe for forwards and backs, but you think probably they all wear football boots anyway.
Yeah.
But do they have different shirts? So if they have that grip stuff on the front, are there certain players that need that grip stuff more than other players on the team?
Perhaps you'd say that forwards would, but then the backs carry the ball as well, you know, so I don't think there's any literally material differences between what the backs and forwards wear, would be in American football, where the players, the offensive and defensive linemen, who would be ready for the after the snap, who basically grapple with each other, they would have very tight jerseys with very short sleeves, whereas the quarterback would have a normal enough shirt with kind of baggy-ish sleeves, because it's not as much of an issue for him. But I think in American football there is a lot of allowance made for the individual's own preferences. And in rugby, I don't think that happens. I'm not sure if it happens at all, really. And I suppose maybe part of that reason is that in American football, every, you know, a player has his own number for the year, and so it's his jersey, whereas in rugby it's 1 to 15, so might be a different guy wearing it the following week and it mightn't suit him.
Yeah, but the size and shape of players is generally determined by the number, isn't it, in rugby?
To a degree it would be, yeah.
Because that's there's two things there. I can't believe that a back in football a back in rugby, because in football it's not as important because everyone's more or less the same shape and weight and everything, all more or less the same, certainly proportionally speaking. Yeah. But in rugby it's very, very different between the backs and the forwards, so to have them all wearing, trying to get into the same, I know there'll be different sizes,
yeah,
but proportionally speaking, some people are going to have bigger shoulders than others and that kind of thing, I would have thought. So you'd think that the shirts would be made for a certain position.
Yeah.
It should be something that they should be thinking about.
Yeah, you'd imagine so, and it might happen in the near future, but it doesn't seem to be a consideration at the moment anyway. There is actually one kind of exception, but it's more from a commercial viewpoint than a performance one, in that Bath had a sponsorship deal with Dyson for the past two seasons, and Dyson have different slogans on different players' shirts. So I'm just looking at a launch picture here, and there's five players lined up, and one of them is Gavin Henson, as it happens, and he has 110,000 RPM written under Dyson. Player next to him has On a Ball, player next to him has Animal, the player next to him has Digital Slim, and the last player is Hot and Cool. And all of these different shirts would be worn in the same game, but they'd all have Dyson written as well.
Okay. So this is not really something we've seen in football, but it is something that myself or John suggested in a podcast number 5, I think. We talked about the possibility of different players having different sponsors on their shirts. So, for example, if they disagree with the ethics of a particular company, they could have a different company on their shirt, perhaps.
But they should have lower wages then too, really, shouldn't they? If they're that ethical, they wouldn't take the money from the company that the company give to the club.
Well, but maybe that is something that could be written into the contract, because instead of having that, well,
I think it's grandstanding anyway.
Well, it's grandstanding from me so far. Not a player hasn't actually demanded it.
Wasn't there talk that someone from Newcastle was not going to have Wanga on his shirt? Was it Pepe's embassy, say?
I think it was. Yep, it was him, I think. Yeah, that was... But it never happened, did it?
Yeah, but he got a bit of publicity out of it by not doing it. So...
Well...
Yeah. But you said we've never seen it in football, but we have seen it in the 1987 FA Cup final when a few of the Tottenham players who were opposed to alcohol didn't have the Halston logo on their shirts.
That is true, because there was about half of a football team was opposed to alcohol in 1987.
Yeah, because in those days,
sure,
no footballers. Well, half the footballers didn't drink. Obviously.
Yeah, that's definitely the case of the 80s. Yeah, I think that was a printing error or something to that effect.
Yeah, but I think it's just indicative of the kind of badly run club Tottenham is.
This you shouldn't be. I'm not sure I'm going to allow someone to be so partisan on here, unless it concerns a certain Glasgow club. The other thing is that rugby still has short shorts.
Yeah.
Now, has rugby ever had big shorts?
I'd imagine back in the old days it did, when the players wore what were known as knickers, when the kit was very similar to football, with rugby having evolved from football. But I think that probably is the kind of an early example of the, you know, the less grabbing area, you'd imagine. Because, you know, if you're trying to tackle someone in his lower body, you've better chance when the shorts are longer. So I'd say that's how that developed.
If I played rugby, I think I'd prefer to have a little bit more short than have the player grab me where he could grab me down there.
Okay, I think he could probably grab you there regardless of the length of your shorts.
Well, yeah, okay. It's probably why so many people play rugby.
Yeah.
I think that is actually maybe an example of where the professionalism didn't come in until 1995, but the baggy shorts supposedly came in 1991, so it sort of missed that transition, maybe.
In terms of the baggy shorts coming in football in 91.
Yeah,
but I suppose they had deviated away from each other by that stage, you know. I don't think there wasn't anything of a replica market in rugby in the early 90s, in the amateur days, so they probably weren't as clued in commercially to worry about trends like that.
Yeah.
You know, you could say that they didn't go for the really short shorts like football did in the 80s either.
That's true. But there's currently no reason, performance-wise, for players in football to wear baggy shorts, is there? It's just a style thing.
I think it's just a style thing, yeah.
Unless to put numbers and bigger sponsors on there as well, I suppose. Speaking of shorts again, in rugby, I don't know if they still do it, but Racing Metro used to have the names on the shorts.
Okay. It seems more likely.
It's something we could do.
It is something we could do in football as well.
Well, I presume you wish that Celtic did it.
No, I don't actually. I would always be happy for a name to be on the back of the Celtic shirt.
But
the numbers
in
the on
face
the shorts
of the, like, a name is where it is because it's over the number. the name is fitted around the number, and you're still breaking the sanctity of the hoops if you put a name on it.
All right. There's two things there. In rugby, this is the thing. Isn't there something that happened with the league, the Football League in the early 90s, where they were going to do something like this?
Apparently so, yeah. That they were going to have squad numbers. But the numbers on the shorts would be 2 to 11.
So, and then the shirts were going to have a squad number, so they would...
Yeah, I think so. But it didn't happen. It was discussed in the summer of 94, but didn't get enough votes, clearly.
So there's two options here, and maybe one way works well for rugby and one way works well for football, is that you could have shirts with the names on it, and then the player keeps the shirt the whole season, and then the shorts have a number on them, and that changes game to game, because then it could go back to your 1 to 11 system, couldn't it?
Yeah, you could. I thought for a while that that's what some Premiership clubs did, rugby Premiership clubs, as opposed to the Premier League in football, which a load of people still call the Premiership 8 years later. But I like, a lot of the Premiership clubs have player names, and then the number is blue on a white background, so it looks just like a big sticker. And I thought that the player had a shirt for the season, and the number was just taken on and off depending on where he's playing. But apparently it's just a sponsorship thing that it's blue and white on every team shirt.
Oh, okay. But that's a terrible thing about rugby. And that is something where they're behind football in the clashes element.
Yeah.
And having a white patch on the back of every shirt is horrendous.
Yeah.
It causes terrible confusion.
Especially seeing as so much of the game is, you know, rucks and mauls where you can only see the players' backs anyway. But that's only the English clubs, I hasten to add.
Yeah. But especially with all the sponsors as well, it just looks like a mess.
Yeah.
But
That's just the way it is. In the Pro 12, well, I'm not sure if it's the case with every team in the Pro 12, but the Irish teams only have one sponsor each anyway. They don't have the kind of mishmash that the English clubs do.
Okay.
Leinster and Munster make an exception one for one game each season, where they're both sponsored by Bank of Ireland, and Bank of Ireland run a kind of a competition for small or medium enterprises to have their name on the shirt for one game.
Ah, okay. So small and medium enterprises that bank through the Bank of Ireland.
I'm not sure if that's a condition, but it would make sense, I suppose, from Bank of Ireland's point of view, yeah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay. Something else that's close to my heart when it comes to rugby is that I don't know who made them. I think it maybe is Canterbury. But the big thing for me is that base layers in football do not represent what the long sleeve shirt would look like all the time. So Blackburn is the main example, that Blackburn will either wear a blue base layer or a white base layer. I think it's white base layer most of the time. And then obviously one of their sleeves is blue, so it looks a little bit stupid on that sleeve. In rugby, they do extend the pattern of the shirt, whatever it is. And in rugby, it's more likely to be patterned than it is in football. Leicester Tigers have tiger stripes in green and red and white or something.
They don't have that kit anymore. That was a few years ago.
Yeah, no, it's not current, I know. But they did have a tiger stripes kit.
Yeah.
And the base layer echoed that. I mean, it more than echoed it. It looked like a long sleeve shirt because it just continued it.
Yeah.
But why are they ahead? It's a simple rule that the base layer.
But I don't think it's a rule in rugby. I think that was Canterbury just pioneering something. I don't think it's a rule at all.
Well, it's a rule in football.
Yeah, but it's not a rule in rugby that the base layer has to have the same design.
But that's even worse, maybe, for football then. That they did something that was innovative, but why hasn't it been done in football when it's required?
I don't know. You'll have to ask a football kit designer.
Well, now you tell me.
I would have thought it would have occurred to you.
Well, it should have occurred to me, but I didn't want to go there. But I have to in this because it's such a great example of something which is glaringly obvious being done because it's the right thing to do, but in football we don't do it.
Yeah, but rugby players don't wear base layers to the extent football players do anyway.
Well, I looked for some pictures of this and it didn't take me very long. Once I'd seen that the base layer existed, I looked for pictures of it and it didn't take me long to find pictures, but it took me a long time to work out that it was actually a base layer being worn and not a long-sleeved shirt because it was so good.
What did you search for?
Well, I don't know, Leicester Tigers in that season, I suppose.
Yeah, so you were looking for that.
Yeah, but it didn't. I didn't have to sift through a lot of Leicester Tigers pictures from matches to find ones where the Leicester Tigers players were wearing those base layers. Maybe they decided to wear base layers that season because they were so good. What's that?
That was the only base layer they could have worn.
Yeah, but they were wearing base layers. You said that rugby players don't wear base layers.
I said they don't wear them to the extent football players do. They're not as ubiquitous in rugby.
That is true. I did comment on it during the World Cup last year that those ponces didn't wear them. Well, I suppose you would regard somebody who does wear a base layer as a ponce first and foremost. Which brings me on to the retailing of this kind of stuff. Now, in rugby, something that happens in football as well, but in rugby they seem to have really grasped it a lot better, is the concept of two versions of the shirts, one for a supporter and one which is what the players wear, but the supporter can also buy if they want to. Now, how long has this been going on for?
Since 2003. Since England and Nike developed the skin tight shirt for that World Cup, and the players' kit changed in a notable way.
Okay, so it was separate from, because as we've said before, up until say 1995 in rugby union, certainly the player's shirt would essentially be a leisure top. It would be a comfortable top that sort of people would wear with body warmers and gilets or whatever they're called now. So in 2003, obviously things changed. Like we said with Clive Woodward, the shirts were more important. The style of shirt they were wearing was much more important, but that wouldn't necessarily be something that was marketable in the same way because people wouldn't want to wear like a tight-fitting top like that. So they now market both. Does everyone do it? I'm not sure Adidas do it, do they? Canterbury do and Nike do, I think.
I changed my original answer. The first big change was in 1999 when New Zealand signed with Adidas. But the New Zealand shirt on field has never carried the three stripes, but the supporters' versions did. But that was just a stylistic change rather than a... Well, I suppose that first New Zealand shirt was actually a big change in terms of performance. So 99 for New Zealand, but in the Northern Hemisphere, England changed in 03, then everyone else started to copy them. And then like you began to notice how there was two different versions marketed.
Okay, just go back to that 99 then. I didn't know about this. So it was always something that I had thought that Adidas, when they took on the New Zealand contract, that was a stipulation that they could never put the stripes on the sleeves.
Yeah.
Are they on the match shirt now?
No, they've never had... The three stripes have never been on a New Zealand shirt.
Okay, in a game. But the supporters one, but the supporters ones. So, as a supporter, you can't buy, or could you buy then the player's shirt to have not have the three stripes?
I'm not sure if you could back then, but I think the replica now is a replica of the match shirt. But definitely in '99, there was this black rugby shirt with three white stripes down the sleeve. There was a, you know, a fairly poor kind of replica version, really.
Yeah, that's a terrible thing.
Yeah.
That, I mean, yeah, that's awful. To not have the option that year of wearing, when it had been agreed that you would never sully the shirt with the three stripes, to have them in white, certainly. If they were in black, it wouldn't have been so bad.
Yeah, well,
if they were contrasting.
The Anfield shirt had a granddad colour, and the supporters one had a rugby shirt colour.
That's even worse still, because then you're saying this is the more traditional version and we're still putting the three stripes on sleeves.
Yeah.
Terrible stuff. Okay. So now we have the two versions. Now, the difference I've noticed between football and rugby is a player's shirt... There's been a change in football, so the better shirts used to be the ones the players wore in, say, the early 90s. They had fully embroidered crests and that kind of thing, and it was just a better quality version. Now they've realised that it's much more important to, in football, to make the players' shirts as light as possible, so they just have transfers of the crest a lot of the time, and say the manufacturer's logo, and the stripes are like painted on, or they're like a rubber strip rather than either tape or like individual material stripes. So that's the way it's gone in football. And if you actually look at the player shirts, a lot of people like to collect them, but they're not going to go through the wash too well, and they just don't look as good close up because they don't need to. All they need to be viewed as is on television, and all right, even if you've got HD, it's not really going to show up that the crest isn't embroidered or isn't stitched on, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But in rugby, there seems to be a different approach to it. So the England shirt, the Canterbury England shirt for the World Cup, is the player shirt is fantastic and the supporter shirt is great. So the supporter shirt has a fully embroidered crest, which looks beautiful. The player shirt, it's like a raised, embossed but also textured plastic, and it's really, really good quality.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that it's being worn by the players and they don't really need it that way, that's encouraging. I would have thought that there's still that effort goes into it.
Yeah, it's hard to know really, like, why make the effort to kind of go all minimalist in terms of what is put on the shirt, and then to go back to this when it was really just kind of basically a version, or it was basically just an example of showing off their technology capabilities, I think, by just saying, oh, look, we've this special injected plastic. So I suppose it calls into question the extent of how much you need to employ the technology on the Anfield shirts. Am I kind of rambling there? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I agree with that maybe, again, like this is something Jason said. So again, it's almost as if you're gearing it to the market again, or the marketing, by creating a product that is able to be sold and compromising the ideals on the pitch. But in this case, I kind of like it because that shirt is much more expensive, I think.
It is,
if you buy the player shirts. It's well over £100, I think.
Yeah.
And so you are actually getting something that's quality. Now, Adidas will sell the Man United player shirt for a similar sort of price, I suppose, maybe a little bit under. But it's rubbish. It's like really, really basic. It's not going to last you very long. So you, as a consumer, you're getting a better product from the rugby.
Yeah. But fans, are the buying public more discerning?
Yeah, I think.
Adidas basically saying that they could put their logo and the Man United crest on a third and it would sell.
Yeah, I think they probably are, which is very, very sad. And it's a horrible way to treat the consumer or the fan, depending on what your politics are. But this is something I thought about. Maybe it's because obviously the amount of money that goes through rugby, despite rugby fans having more money, because there's less of them and it's not as commercialised, I don't know, there's not as much money as going to go through it. But I wonder who, in terms of conversion, in terms of actually hitting what the sales targets are, I wonder who's more intelligent. Paul Daniels, the English magician, said once that there is such a thing as genetic knowledge. So he's in favour of hereditary peers in the House of Lords in the UK because they have genetic knowledge. And I wonder with the whole middle to upper class background of rugby, maybe there's a certain intelligence there in business that means they do things a little bit better. I don't know.
Well, Frank Skinner used to tell the story of his father who was, you know, working class man living in West Bromwich, wasn't it? And he voted Conservative all his life because he felt that, you know, these were the upper class guys who were well educated, you know, and who were born to govern, basically.
Well, if that is the conclusion, if that's the conclusion of this podcast. But maybe it's that football fans, there is an assumption that you can pull the wool over the eyes of the football fan and maybe not the rugby fan. You actually need to provide them with quality. But one of the best marketing I've ever seen, and I don't know how it's possible, if you go within, say, 100 miles of Northampton in the middle of England, if you see a Range Rover, it will have a little Saint stick man on it.
Okay.
So like the Roger Moore, the Saint logo, but it's carried a rugby ball with a little halo on the top.
Yeah.
And virtually every Range Rover car in that area, you'll see this. And I don't know how much money they make from these things, but it must be so much.
Yeah.
Just the amount of times I see these on the road is just crazy. More than I ever see shirts or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I'd like to see the figures for the car badge, the Saints, the Northampton Saints Rugby Football Club car badge. That is my wish to see the sales figures for that.
Yeah, but are you saying that only rugby fans buy Range Rovers?
I don't know what comes first.
Okay.
It's a chicken egg thing, I think.
Right.
It's a chicken egg chaser thing.
Yeah. Very good.
Okay. So that has been rugby. I think we've covered a lot of things there, Dennis. Have you enjoyed talking about rugby? I don't know if we're ever going to revisit that, but we've covered a lot of things. The influence on football, where it doesn't influence football, where it should influence football, maybe.
Yes.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, other than just everyone should visit my site because it's great.
Yeah, but we'll get to that bit, Dennis. That bit always comes at the very end. I've got other things to talk about.
Oh, sorry. In rugby, in international rugby, the home team still changes shirt when there's a colour clash.
Oh, so the way it used to be in football, certainly in friendlies, that's still the case in rugby?
Yeah, it used to be the case in all football in the early 20th century.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In the early, right, okay. So in domestic football as well?
Yeah.
All right. And
it's still the case in amateur football here, I think, anyway. Lower level, anyway.
I don't think it is in the UK, I'm not sure.
Okay.
So is that the same? That goes for club rugby as well, the home team will change?
It changed in the European Cup in about 2002, after the first few years of it. And I think in the Pro 12, it's the away team changes now as well. But they've kept the tradition at international level.
Oh, okay. Okay. Interesting stuff.
Yeah, South Africa will change against Scotland to our navy, but not against New Zealand to our black. So the South African New Zealand games aren't actually ideal to watch.
Yeah, that's quite a dark shirt, isn't it?
Yeah.
South Africa. Okay, well that's surprising. Why? Because it's such a big game, I suppose.
I'd
is it?
Imagine the so. News... Yeah. You'd think in such a big game, you'd want people to be able to tell the teams better apart. But
was that the case in the '95 final then? Yeah.
Yeah, South Africa's shirts weren't as dark then.
Okay, but now they are. Okay, fair enough. All right. Okay, so that is rugby. We've covered rugby. I think there are still things to think about there, whether it's ahead of football or behind football, or whether football can learn from it, or whether rugby can learn from football. But we'll see how the next few years come. Yeah, the technology thing is the thing. Rugby seems to be ahead in that way, and for whatever reason, football's lagging behind there, and it is lagging now. It should be more involved in it. I don't. There's too much money in it for them not to be taking proper tracking information and heart rate information during games to find out. Because you could be basing your substitutions at the beginning of the game. You should be basing your substitutions based on the fitness of the players during the game. And you should know that from previous games. And they don't seem to, I don't think. They will do from distance covered over different sections of the
match, but rugby you can bring on all 8 subs, whereas in football you can only bring on 3 from 7, so the substitutions in football are far more dependent on how the game is going, whereas they're almost pre-planned in rugby.
Which
I think has a link with the increasing number of concussions, but that is definitely a discussion for another day.
All right. Yeah, we will discuss that another day, maybe. Or you meant not with me, with someone more intelligent.
I didn't imply anything.
Okay, so that is rugby done. Now, we have some corrections and retractions to make from things that were said in previous podcasts. In podcast number 5, I said to John Devlin said that England didn't have the Admiral logo in the 1982 World Cup because they thought they weren't allowed it, and then it turned out that they were allowed it. I told him he was wrong. It was the 1980 European Championships, as that was the case. We were kind of both right and wrong. Would you agree with that, Dennis?
Yeah.
Okay. Because England in the 1980 European Championships did not wear the Admiral logo on their shirts. In the 1982 World Cup, they didn't wear the Admiral logo in the first game against France, but then in subsequent games, they did. It did return to the shirts. So we were kind of both right, but I shouldn't have told John he was wrong. Let's put it that way. The other thing we said is that in the 1984 European Cup final, Liverpool had the Umbro logos taped over. That is incorrect, isn't it, Dennis?
Yeah, because it's 81, isn't it?
It was the 81 European Cup final that it's since been pointed out to me by Shaky. So Shaky is a friend of the podcast. He said that in the 81 European Cup final, the Real Madrid president, I think it was the president, was moaning because Liverpool had the Umbro logo showing, so they were taped over when Real Madrid were wearing Adidas, and obviously they had long. The 3 stripes on the sleeves, so there was a lot more branding on the Real Madrid shirts than there was on the Liverpool shirts, but that's a little bit of an extra point on that. Any comments on that, Dennis?
No, I'm just impressed by your attention to detail in terms of the clarifications.
Yeah, it's important stuff. In the last podcast, podcast 6, which was with Jason Lee, I said that Manchester United do not have a bespoke kit this season. I misspoke when I said that. They do have a bespoke kit this season. Clearly, that's what I meant. I did not say that, though, so I just want to make that clear that I'm aware that Manchester United have a bespoke Adidas kit this season.
Well, they have two, really, don't they?
Well, they have three, don't they?
Well, wouldn't you say that the home and away are the same bespoke kit?
I suppose
part of a template, isn't it?
Yeah, okay, so the first, home and away shirt. Oh, sorry, you're saying the third is a template as well?
Aren't all the Adidas third kits the same template with the jersey shorts?
Okay. I think you could still class it as a bespoke kit because of the colours, maybe? It's a grey area.
It's a black and thermal orange area.
Oh, God. Okay, so that is those are the corrections. If there's anything else, just let us know. My name is Jay. I can be contacted on Twitter, J29ers. Design Football can be contacted on Twitter, is Design Football. Designfootball.com on Facebook. Designfootball.com is the website. Dennis has some websites that I'll try and tell people about them, Dennis, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay, Museum of Jerseys is, I think it's now, it's changed, hasn't it? It's been updated.
Yeah, it's been modernised.
So museumofjerseys.com is a blog now, so you can visit there and you will have new stories on there as well. But you could also, that is also a portal to arrive at corkcitykits.com, prideofthejersey.com, internationalrugbyshirts.com, and what's the address for the squad numbers one?
Squadnumbers.wordpress.com.
Okay, all fantastic sites. Everyone should visit those. Museumofjerseys.com is on Facebook also. And Museum of Jerseys, is that the Twitter name?
Yep.
That is the Twitter name. So you can send your comments Dennis's way there. Thanks very much, Dennis. Did you enjoy talking about rugby?
I did indeed. It's always a pleasure to be on the best football kids podcast on the internet.
Yeah, okay, we all know what he means by that. Okay, thanks very much, Dennis. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.